Assalamu alaikum, peace be with you, and welcome to Islam and Life with me, Tariq Ramadan, broadcasting from London. In today's show, we ask the question, Islam and bioethics. How does Islam tackle new questions from a new field?
The fields of medicine and biology are going through a quiet revolution. New understandings of life have been unlocked since the mapping of the human genome over a decade ago. This promises a host of new medical treatments, from regenerative stem cell therapies to person-specific pharmacology, from new IVF techniques to synthetic vaccines. Islamic thought has a long and rich history in guiding the ethical use of medicine. So today on Islam and Life, we'll explore the moral implications of these new developments in bioethics. Islam and bioethics. How does Islam tackle new questions from a new field?
There are, in fact, new developments in bioethics and all this discussion that we have now and new questions, because we have new knowledge and new understandings about life and what it is all about. And, of course, we don't know everything, but there are new questions. And when it comes to the brain, when it comes to the brain death, when it comes to our life, euthanasia, and when it comes to cloning, for example, so these are very important questions. And from the very beginning, there was no contradiction from an Islamic perspective and understanding between faith and deep faith and knowledge and science. It's as if to know more was the right way to believe better. So now, are we threatened by these new understandings and these new technologies that are now coming with new questions about life? These are critical and crucial questions, and the Muslims very often seem to be very far from coming to an answer and a new vision and to contribute to these questions when it comes to ecology, medicine, and anything which has to do with bioethics. So, important questions. Well, to answer these questions, I'm joined by Imam and scientist Usama Hassan. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's also your field. You have been trained in religious studies, but also you are a physician, and this is also your field. So if we start with a very simple question, because, you know, when we speak about bioethics, the first question is, oh, what are we talking about? What is it exactly that we are referring to? So could you start with a kind of a definition from your field, and in fact the two fields on which you are working?
Sure. Well, very simply, bioethics is about the ethics derived from the biological sciences, which are the sciences of life, and therefore they cover the plant world, the animal world, and of course the human world, and medicine is especially.
In which way and in what exactly?
So for example, the latest developments would be things like genetic engineering, cloning techniques, which are being applied to plants and animals already, you know, especially in the West, and people are thinking of applying these things to human beings. The DNA, the Human Genome Project, which was mentioned there in the clip, that has been mapped out for the entire human DNA. Now, that raises all kinds of possibilities in terms of medical treatments, but also could be used for shady purposes, such as trying to breed superior races, etc., as the Nazis tried, of course, last century.
So let us, before coming to these questions and to see what and how the Muslims and the Muslim scholars are dealing with these issues, and from a practical way, but also from a textual referential attitude and understanding, let us come to the Islamic tradition, because there is something which is important in anything which has to do with the legal framework. We are talking about fiqh, Islamic law and jurisprudence, but we are also talking about usul, the fundamentals, and we talk in that field about the objectives, and the classical school of al-maqasid is to speak about five main principles, and al-Qarafi, one of the scholars, is adding another one about dignity, but it's all about protecting religion, protecting human integrity, protecting the intellect, the family, and the goods. We all have all this, and very often the scholars of today are saying these principles are helping us to tackle these problems and to come with the right vision, at least about the ends that we want to protect and to reach, and the purposes of life. What do we have from the classical tradition that we can add to this when it comes to the contemporary discussions on bioethics?
Well, as you said, we have the approach of Maqasid, which is to preserve the higher principles or objectives of human welfare effectively, so especially human life, the human intellect, property, etc. But in addition to the classical scholars you mentioned, you know, from Ibn Taymiyyah onwards and Shatibi onwards till now, many jurists speak about widening the number of maqasid to things like promotion of medical science and research, promotion of welfare in general, fundamental rights and liberties, and you know, you've written a lot on this also. So we come to an overall picture, which is that we are trying to preserve God's sacred creation and also our capability and our ability to worship God and recognize that sacredness in dealing with these. So coming back to an earlier question of yours, I don't feel threatened by the new discoveries. I find it wonderful. It's a sign of Allah. It is ayatullah in nature when we learn about the origins of DNA and the details of how living things develop and grow, etc. But we are faced with difficult moral choices when it comes to, for example, cloning human beings or genetic engineering, perhaps even genetic engineering of human beings. Now, these are serious moral questions because the technology exists. Make no mistake, scientists can do all kinds of things which many of us would find very offensive.
So let us,
that's where the fuqaha and the scientists should come together as Muslims, people. We should present what our faith teaches, what ethics do we have, and what do we do, and what don't we do.
Yes, there is something which is important in that field. Maybe in the medical science, in the medical field, this is where the Muslims and the Islamic tradition is maybe the best equipped today, because for at least the last half century, you have Muslim scholars and medical doctors sitting together and coming with new responses, because they are dealing with a field which is very precise, very focused, with very delicate, in fact, questions and very precise challenges for the medical doctors. So dealing with euthanasia and dealing with cloning, it's coming now. It's not an easy discussion because it's always improving and always being more complex, the complexification of science. So what is, for example, coming from the Islamic tradition, the contemporary Islamic thought on this? In which way do you see it? Do you see it improving? Do you see it tackling the issue, for example, when you were talking beyond the field of medical science, for example, genetic engineering, for example, which is a very dangerous field, in fact. How do you see the Muslims responding to this today?
Well, I think it's slowly we are formulating responses, as I think you've described very well in your book, Radical Reform. The scientists as well as the religious scholars coming together and understanding each other's fields and coming up with joint answers to these things. And of course, we have much more to go also in terms of understanding how all this fits in with our wider principles. But there are many fatwas, for example, on, say, abortion, euthanasia, even on cloning, etc. But sometimes we need to know more the reality. So, for example, genetic engineering in plants and animals is widespread in Western farming methods, for example. Yeah. You know, cows whose genes have been altered to produce more milk, for example, all kinds of crops to improve the yield, etc. Now, many of the major companies argue that genetically modified crops are the only way to solve the world's hunger problem, for example. Their skeptics argue that these will actually give you a monopoly because your genetically modified seeds will only take root.
So what would be an Islamic answer to that? Tell us.
Well, the Islamic answer, the answer would be to look at the debate very carefully.
Yes.
And certainly we would like to get rid of the world's hunger problems, but also I think we'd be opposed to monopolization or a small group of capitalists controlling the world's resources. That seems to be a real problem and danger over the last few decades. And we would have to come up with very bold and courageous kind of answers to these things and say, look, if this technique is helping to solve hunger problems, increase yield, etc., then we should welcome that. But if it's doing that at the expense of poor local farmers, for example, destroying local economies for the benefit of worldwide capitalist multinationals,
would you say that
would be very dangerous, and we would have to find ways of somehow coming to a balance on these.
Yes, but would you say that, for example, this is what we have now coming from the Muslim scholars? Are they aware of the complexity and all the dimensions that you are referring to?
On those issues, perhaps not, but I think they will become aware of these things as more Muslims who are learning in fields of religion as well as the sciences and in contemporary activism, the more who get involved with these things, you know, the information and the knowledge will flow through, will percolate, and people will be aware. It's not a simple question of is this halal or haram, you know, what's the fatwa?
It's more complex than that.
It's what do we do in this situation for the benefit of humanity at large?
But this is the problem, you see, in what you are saying. You are saying they will get with an answer, and that's all good. This is what we hope. The problem is, do we have the methodology to get the answer? Because, for example, we are speaking about, you know, crops and the modified situation in which, you know, the scientists are now getting at a level that they can modify the organs and push them in a way which is to, in fact, do with science what they are not ready to do with economy, which is a more equal economy. So we try to use science to help, and in that way we also have to come with a scientific answer taking into account the economic dimension. Yes. For example, for the organ transplants, when we know today that yes, in Islam there is no prohibition on this, we can do it, and it's allowed. Now we have scholars even saying you can even sell your organs to be just because it's, when you are poor, is the way for you to survive. Yeah. And you have other scholars saying yes, we can do this, and this is right. But we also know when it comes to the field of economy that it's very expensive when we are in, for example, in hospitals. So there is an economic pressure to push you in one way to say, okay, he's dead, we are going to take the organs to give them to someone who is alive. So the economic dimension is as important as the scientific one. And it's as if here, from an Islamic perspective, there is a lack of methodology. We don't have this comprehensive approach which is helping us to come with effective answers for our time.
Well, that's something that certainly needs to develop in the Muslim world. I think one of the strengths the West has is strong civic society, including the learned societies. So here in London, we have very old royal societies for art, science, for physics and astronomy and mathematics and all these fields. And the practitioners in those fields have, from the beginning, expressed their ethical guidelines over new controversial issues. And government and other bodies take that into account when they make laws, for example. And when you do that in a good way, you have enough organized experts and activists who are concerned about these things. Then,
but would you say, for example, that in the West we have the ethical answer to this? Because it's as if now we are separating the field of economy and the field of science and any ethical questions. At least money matters more than ethics.
Well, the big problem, actually, I think, as we've seen, is the financial system, which the world is so prone to, or its fluctuation. That is a serious problem for the whole world, I think, at the moment. But certainly, the many people in the West, of course, informed by ethics and values, and take that very strongly, whether they're from a Christian or Jewish or Muslim or other perspective.
Or atheists even, who are very much involved in that.
Yes, or humanists, who may not have a faith, but they do believe in certain important principles. So I think we have that. And in the Muslim world, we have a specific and very vibrant tradition, actually, of faith, etc., which we need to use to come to the debate and bring some answers and also laws and inspire people to do the right thing.
So let us be pragmatical and now we know which kind of problems we have in many fields, and you were mentioning them at the beginning. So what would be the first steps that we have to go through in order to improve the situation? Because the perception is many Muslims and many Muslim scholars, they think that all these problems, we have more important problems on the ground when it comes to poverty, when it comes to democratization, when it comes to freedom. What would be the first steps in your field, for example, that you think we should promote in order to improve the situation?
I think we need to promote the wealth of learning and the classical diversity on some of these issues, which again you've highlighted in your books. Abortion, for example.
Yes.
I mean, if you are brought up with most of the mosques in the West, I would imagine, amongst the communities and maybe in the Muslim world also, there is this perception that abortion is strictly prohibited. It's murder. Which is, the phrase abortion is murder actually comes from the Christian West, actually. But a moment's reflection, anybody knows about Islamic law knows that a fetus was never considered as a full human life, that if you accidentally carried out abortion, it was never the blood money was never that of a full human being. So to say abortion is murder would not be an Islamic thing to say. And there's a diversity of views as to whether abortion is allowed before 40 days or 120 days or under what conditions, such as rape or even the welfare of the child, etc.
So the first step will be, in fact, to know better our own tradition and the diversity of views within the tradition.
Yes, because we have cases. You know, we've had cases in our mosque, for example, girls who get pregnant before marriage and the bump is going to show on the wedding day. I had that question put to me. Am I allowed to abort? This was a sister who had done it once before. She was asking for permission to abort again because she was going to get married in 3 months' time and her pregnancy would be obvious, and this would cause great shame to both families. And another case where a sister was going through a divorce with her first husband who was very violent, but she had become pregnant by him, and she really wanted to abort the child. She didn't want her husband's child. However, I managed to convince her that maybe that wasn't the best thing to do, and a year later she rang me to thank me for saving her child because she really loved her baby. So we have to...
So it's a case...
I think it's a case-by-case situation because...
This is the very meaning of a fatwa, in fact.
Exactly.
And is that for someone in a specific situation, and sometimes we can come with an answer, which is a fatwa, which is not following the overall, you know, general vision of Islam, but in this case, for this person, in this situation, the fatwa is saying, you can do it. You can go for that.
And for me, that would be part of the overall vision of Islam, because the vision of Islam is to do the best for everyone in their situation. So yes, you have a general fatwa, which will generally work most of the time, but occasionally there will be exceptions. But also practicalities have to be taken into account. For example, the 120 days is often mentioned as well. You know, abortions are kind of allowed before then in some situations. But 120 days is 17 weeks and one day. Now, statistics show that 90% of abortions, even in the West, are carried out about 10 weeks, 10 to 12 weeks, no later than that. So it can be actually very responsible for a faqih to say, oh, you can abort before 120 days, because you would actually multiply the amount of abortion. It's actually quite restricted in the West. And Muslims often think that, oh God, the West is so permissive and so lax.
There is sometimes a lack of understanding, not only of the Islamic tradition, but also of some of the ethical ground that we find in the West. It might be a better... So once again, we come back to what we were saying at the beginning. It's quite important to get a better knowledge of the wide Islamic tradition with so many views that are open to interpretation and helping us to come with a better implementation for today, but also to know the environment and the level of the questions and the complexities of the situation that we are facing in different fields.
Yes, and the situation people are in. So, for example, with organ transplants, blood transfusions, you know, there are still a small minority of scholars who say here, even in the West, that blood transfusions are prohibited, that organ transplantation is prohibited. Now, you know, my wife's been through 3 pregnancies, and in each one she needed large blood transfusions because she had cesareans, for example. Now, under that fatwa, you know, she wouldn't be here. She wouldn't be alive because there was no way they could have kept her alive. And so sometimes, you know, the medical doctors need to tell the fuqaha in great detail what's going on, or actually bring them to the hospitals. And in fact, I mean, everyone's a human being. People do go to hospitals when they become parents, for example, or when they or their children become ill. And
but you mean when delivering a fatwa, it's important to get to the field and to know what is happening.
Yes, and to integrate that. I mean, it seems to me some people leave that leave all the experiences outside, say, the mosque or the madrasa, as though they're schizophrenic and say, well, that's out there in the wicked wild world, but when I come back to my fatwa, well, I only read my books and the classical books. And that's not right, because we are human beings, and all of our experiences, they come from Allah to help teach us.
If you were to talk about what is happening now on the ground of scientific discoveries and technologies and what we have now, what would you see as the main challenge for the Muslims? In which field we still have to work a lot to come with effective and efficient answers?
I think the field of genetics, and certainly human genetics, poses very difficult questions. And in fact, it's to do with the nature of life itself. You know, what is life? That's actually a very difficult question, because you probably know in the scientific world there is no agreed definition for what is life. Actually, every field has its own definition, but generally it's understood to be a complex process, the level of complexity, and that has a bearing, of course, on, again, questions like abortion or terminating life, euthanasia, palliative care, etc. But you know, even in Quranic terms, plants are alive. You know, yukhrijul hayya min al-mayyit. Plants and animals are alive. But a human being, if you like, have the fullest sense of life and ruh.
Because of the ruh and because of the damir, the conscience,
exactly.
As well. Yeah.
It's the ruh of God. Mm-hmm. But that is the most highly developed in human beings. And therefore, as people argue, for example, that ensoulment, you know, the ruh does not appear to many modern scientists to come suddenly after 40 days, 120 days. Yeah. More it's a gradual process,
yes. Mm.
Which reaches the peak somewhere. Mm. If nuances like that can be understood, it's more like a spectrum.
Mm.
And just as we have in other areas of law, so for example, an 80-year-old great-grandfather is an adult just the way as an 18-year-old is. But,
yeah.
You know, one is more of an adult, really. But in law, they're equal. Mm. Once a child reaches 18, for example. So you have to have laws and cut-off points somewhere.
Mm.
But, again, be aware of the fact that it may not be as black and white and as simple as that.
So I think that, once again, we come again to solve these problems. We need to have, you know, scholars knowing the fields and geneticians, in fact, because this is very complex. This complexification of science and knowledge is something which is sometimes not enough challenging the traditional framework of our legal system and the objectives, the high objectives that we have. So I think that there is here a lack of dialogue, a communication between, so to speak, the two worlds, the world of science. And the world of legal, religious responses. So why is it so? Why do you think, why do we have this problem? It's something which is a deep crisis, while at the same time, the Muslims around the world are saying, we are connecting, you know, our ethics is in science. We are not preventing the scientists to get knowledge, but we want knowledge with meaning. We want knowledge with objectives. And still, when you come to the ground, there is a fracture, a gap between the two worlds.
Well, I think it's partly human nature, and you'll find that in other faiths, other countries also.
Hmm.
You know, the lawyer doesn't understand the engineer, who doesn't understand the medical doctor, for example, who doesn't understand the social scientist. So I think that's the nature of human knowledge. But Muslims and others have a very strong sense of the unity of knowledge, because that reflects Allah's unity, the tawheed. And the
oneness of God in the unity of knowledge.
Of knowledge, because all knowledge comes from God in the end. Mm. So therefore, it has to be interconnected. So the more that we can do to increase this dialogue and get people to understand each other. And in fact, we have something very valuable in the Islamic tradition, which is the Ijtihad Jama'i.
And
the
which is collective and community. Yeah.
The collective Ijtihad. As you mentioned, the many fatwa bodies on medical sciences and other issues, they do bring scientists and religious scholars together. But perhaps they should also bring social scientists now, economists, you know, activists, who look at the socio-economic and global dimension of these issues also for some
but
of the
there is something that also that we can add here, because very often in the West, this perception that, you know, scholars and religious scholars are involved in science is as if, oh, we are coming back to the old Middle Ages where sciences were under the authority of religions. And the perception that, you know, knowledge was prevented from, you know, religious because this was threatening the very, you know, belief in God. What we are talking about here is not this at all, is go as far as you can as to the knowledge, but don't forget that with knowledge there is ends, purposes, objectives, meanings, and things that are also to be ethics, that is an applied ethics. So it's not to prevent science and knowledge from getting as far as possible, but is to give a direction. And I think that this is also something which could be a contribution of the Muslims to this, isn't it?
Yes, certainly the relationship between religion and science, or the different branches of knowledge, I think it's certainly an important contribution we can make. As you suggested there, there's a new book by Ahmed Dallal on science and religion which makes that point that early theologians and scientists were quite clear, actually, that there should be no limitation of science because it is a study of God's creation. Science, that's basically what it is. It's a study of Khalqullah and the Ayatullah, the signs of God in creation. And that's why, for me, it's a beautiful thing, and always strengthened my faith every time I learn about new scientific discoveries. So that should be allowed to continue, with good intention, of course, but there must always be the ethical guidance. Because, for example, I mean, I'm a physicist, and, you know, we've achieved great things in physics in the last few hundred years, but we've also achieved something very bad. For example, nuclear weapons, you know, that the physicists developed that, and there was split over it. Now, many of us believe ethically that we should not develop weapons of mass destruction, and they include the nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons, etc. I think that's a very good example of where The science is great, but you can do very damaging things with it. And we should be able to say that, no, we won't go there, we won't do this. Even though it's possible,
yes.
But as people of faith in God, we have a moral duty not to go there.
Thank you so much, Sheikh, for all this input. I think it's quite important, even some scholars saying, you know, Islamic nuclear weapon is a contradiction in terms. So I think that during this discussion, we have been able to come to some of this important. The first thing is really to understand what bioethics is. It's really about ethics in dealing with everything which has to do with life, understanding death as well, and coming with accurate answers, because our knowledge today and our understandings and our technologies in all these fields are now very deep and complexified with new discoveries. So at the same time, is really how do we come to this, and what we were saying is really important to come to a better understanding of the Islamic tradition, because this Islamic tradition is wider than what we think, and many scholars were coming with very, very diverse answers for specific questions with the knowledge of their time, and then we have to come back to this, but also to get a better understanding of what all these techniques and all these challenges are, with a better knowledge of the level of our understanding is different sciences, and when it comes to life, to death, and to all the techniques that we have. So I think that this double knowledge, this is what you were saying, is quite important, and to be able to get from all the people of knowledge in specific fields, this is important as well. So that's all we have time for. Please let us know your thoughts and views on any of the shows you have seen, and here is the way to contact us.
We'd like to hear your views on today's show, as well as ideas for future programs. You can do this by emailing us at islamandlife@presstv.co.uk. You can also join our Facebook page by searching Islam and Life on Press TV, where you can view past programs, keep up to date on future shows, leave comments, and meet other Islam and Life fans.
And finally, I would like to thank my guest, Dr. Osama Hassan. Thank you so much for your input and your contribution in that very complex discussion about bioethics. And I hope to see you next week, inshallah.